Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. My guest is Homer Vinters. He's the former chief medical officer of the New York jail system, and he currently works as a federal monitor of health services in several jail and prison settings, and is an adjunct faculty member at New York University's College of Global Public Health. He's also the author of Life and Death in Rikers Island. His latest book, which we'll discuss today, was published by Johns Hopkins University Press. It's titled Outbreak Behind Bars, Spider Bites, Human Rights, and the Unseen Danger to Public Health. Welcome to the exchange, Dr. Vinters.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's start with your background. Tell me about your career experience.
I trained as an internist, but I did a fellowship in public health research, and that fellowship really was focused on the care people get in immigration detention and other places, jails and prisons where people are detained. And that led me into working in the New York City jail system, which is an independent health system. It was part of the Department of Health. And I worked there, worked my way up to be the chief medical officer, and worked for a little bit in international human rights. And now work, as you mentioned, mostly as a federal monitor to look into jail and prison conditions and investigate deaths.
Well, your book speaks to communicable diseases spread in jails and prisons. What would you say is the most basic health risk for incarcerated individuals?
Well, I think the health risks, just like each of us as a person has different health profiles, I think the health risks differ quite a bit. Some places, some jails, prisons, or detention centers, the health risk might be centered around violence, physical violence, sexual violence. Some places it might be infection or injury, and some places it might be interruption of chronic care or poor treatment for chronic diseases or a lack of adequate mental health services. One common problem, I will say, is that the number one cause of death in U.S. jails is suicide. And that speaks both to who's going into jails, but also the lack of adequate health care in those places.
How many people are in our jails?
At any given time, we have about 2 million people locked up in this country. It's a little bit different if you look at jails versus prisons. We have about 3,000 jails, which is mostly people in pretrial or short sentence situations, but people cycle through those. So most of the detentions or incarcerations that happen in a year are happening in those jails. People in prison are there for longer, but taken together along with immigration detention, we have, give or take 2 million people who are locked up.
When you speak of health risks and the disparity, is there any notable disparity between the jails and the prisons?
Yes, I think that jails are very chaotic. People are coming in having just been arrested. So there are high rates of health risks for intoxication. If people were using substances and withdrawal, people often are forced into withdrawal for which they don't get treatment. And withdrawing from use of opiates, certainly alcohol, benzodiazepines, those can be fatal withdrawals. And so if people go into a jail and they just get tossed in a cell and maybe given some water or Gatorade, that can lead to fatal withdrawal. So that profile can also drive suicides because we know that being in withdrawal increases suicide risk. So that very chaotic picture is a little more characteristic of jails.
Roughly, how many people are dying in jails and prisons each year?
Well, we don't know. That is a fine question. There have been several efforts, national efforts, to try and codify or mandate reporting of deaths. It's just the most bleak, stark health outcome, right? Death. And those efforts actually have fallen away in the last couple of years. So we probably know less today than we did a few years ago. It seems that the best data is several thousand people die every year in jails and prisons. But just knowing that is actually murkier today than it has been in recent years.
So, doctor, your research is about collecting data, and the federal government collects data, and the state collects data, and the private prisons collect data. How can someone die in a prison or jail, and we do not have exactly that data?
Well, that is even asking that question really is a strong but correct indictment of our public health system in this country. We know more about people who die in car accidents or people who get injured on e-bikes probably than we do just the basics of who's dying behind bars. Part of that is because there have been some efforts at a federal level to mandate reporting of prison and jail deaths. But the participation in that and the consequences for not participating, for not reporting deaths nationally to a federal agency have really been weakened. And so we know pretty well how many people die in state prison systems, because most state prison systems are connected to state governing bodies that will record those deaths. The jails, the chaos of jails is really where we lose a lot of information. And it's also important to say that, you know, jails may simply quickly let somebody out of their custody in the final moments or the final hours before they die, so that a person who's found down in a jail may be transported by EMS to a local hospital and a wand is quickly waved to say that they're no longer in custody. And so that kind of death also escapes any scrutiny, even if there is good reporting.
You're painting a bleak picture. Michelle Alexander became famous after she wrote the book, The New Jim Crow, about the system of mass incarceration. Is race a factor in how people are treated in the jail and prison system?
That is certainly my experience. She and many others, Mindy Fullalove and Bob Fullalove, are sociologists and psychiatrists who have characterized this very well. The path into these places certainly is heavily impacted by race and by poverty. But once people are there, disparities persist and they can get worse. And so there has been good research on, for instance, who goes into solitary confinement and who doesn't. When I was leading the New York City Jail Health Service, we looked at our own operations to look for racial disparities. And, you know, what we found was troubling, which was that our white patients were more likely to come into the health service in what you would think of as kind of a traditional mode, where they come in the front door, they meet a clinician, they get assessed, whereas the non-white patients were more likely to come into the mental health service later on when there was a problem. That is, there was some discipline being imposed upon them, and then there was a mandated mental health contact. And so I do believe that these disparities certainly drive the path into jails, prisons, and immigration detention, but there can be no more clear example of it that, you know, the people being swept off the streets today, going into immigration detention centers, the first point of contact occurs because of the color of their skin often.
Right. My guest is Dr. Homer Venters. He's the author of Outbreak Behind Bars, Spider Bites, Human Rights, and the Unseen Danger to Public Health. So let's dive into your book. Can you read an excerpt from your opening?
Sure. Dennis Oya started coughing in late 2019 in a Washington state prison and kept on coughing for a year and a half until he'd broken three of his ribs. In addition to his cough, Mr. Oya started having trouble breathing. "Every time I call home," he said, "you could hear me coughing. I couldn't get a full 20-minute conversation with my family because of shortness of breath." Mr. Oya knew he might be suffering from tuberculosis or TB because he'd been diagnosed with the infection as a boy. But when he reported his problems to health staff, he was tested for COVID-19. And when that workup was negative, he was assessed for having a hernia and allergies. Mr. Oya would go almost 18 months before health staff in his prison listened to him, conducted a test for TB, and finally diagnosed him with a treatable but deadly and highly communicable disease. His infection would trigger one of the largest prison TB outbreaks in decades.
That is amazing. How did you learn of Mr. Oya's case?
His case actually was brought to national attention because an epidemiologist at the University of Utah, Dr. Walter, she wrote up his story for The Nation. And so she's an epidemiologist, but she's also a journalist. And so she did this amazing research into understanding the details of his case. And this story resonated with me because Mr. Oya's experience was so similar to what I've seen in other outbreaks, that a patient or groups of patients will tell the health staff of their jail or prison, exactly what needs to be heard, which is they have symptoms of an outbreak, they have symptoms of a communicable disease, but the health service isn't equipped or doesn't respond to and listen to them. And that lack of attention to what's being told to the health service, in Mr. Oya's case, really resonated with me in the work I've done in other settings.
Dr. Venters, you write, quote, "Delivering care behind bars is a constant exercise in interruptions for many reasons," end quote. Tell me why.
Well, to start with the people delivering the care, they are accustomed to nonstop interruptions. There may be security events, there may be very mundane operations of the jail or prison that stop them from seeing a particular patient or stop their operations. Because these are boxes, these are facilities built for another purpose. The healthcare is often second or third or fourth in priority. But the patients, and this is really where, especially with the staphylococcal skin infections, we see this, the patients may report over and over the same problem. They may even get in front of a provider who then does the correct assessment and prescribes the right medicine. But so often that medicine gets interrupted. If the patient moves housing areas, if the medication expires and the order needs to be rewritten, there are so many ways that treatment can be interrupted, along with the barriers to getting the initial diagnosis.
And then there's the believability factor.
Yes, these are the power dynamic, the focus on security, and the tendency to disbelieve patients. And I would say it's not across the board a uniform problem. It's that patients who are in the mental health service, patients who have been deemed by the health service to be either not believable or malingering or simply too much of a hassle for the health service, those patients may then report cardinal signs, textbook signs of a health problem, but already the frame of the health service is to not believe them. And there are many institutional factors that contribute to this lack of believing patients.
Well, jails and prisons seem to have been a playground for the COVID virus to spread. Isn't that hazardous to everyone working in those facilities?
Yes, it is. And it is important to identify that anytime there's an outbreak in a jail, a prison, or immigration detention center, or juvenile detention center, the staff are often experiencing some of the same problems as the patients are. So yes, the mortality and morbidity for correctional officers and correctional health staff was very serious during COVID. The difference is that most of those people were able to get to a hospital. If they became seriously ill, get admitted, get into an intensive care unit, whereas many people who were detained or incarcerated were simply left to their own devices or had to rely on their neighbors in their housing area to take care of them.
That is amazing to me. So it sounds like there's a lack of empathy.
Yes, that is a problem. I think that it is jails and prisons, as they're operated in many places, are dehumanizing. And they're dehumanizing in a way that I think puts exclusively the blame on a bad correctional officer or on security staff. But if one correctional officer is tasked with guarding or overseeing the security for hundreds of people in an overnight shift, then it is hard to fathom how that one correctional officer is going to be able to identify who's sick. And so that scenario where there are just no staff or nowhere close to adequate staff to even respond to a medical emergency or to somebody who's sick, that is quite common in jails and prisons. And so the dehumanization that's occurring isn't just a feature of a personal characteristic flaw. It really is built into the institutional model.
Let's hold that thought. We have to take a short break. My guest is Dr. Homer Venters. He's the author of Outbreak Behind Bars, Spider Bites, Human Rights, and the Unseen Danger to Public Health. I'm Mike Green. You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. My guest is Dr. Homer Venters. He's the author of Outbreak Behind Bars, Spider Bites, Human Rights, and the Unseen Danger to Public Health. And before the break, we were talking about empathy and the lack thereof, the dehumanizing system that is part of our jails and prisons. And Dr. Venters, you write about the intentional overcrowding in an Alabama prison. Tell me about that.
The stories from that system really involve just a lack of space and adequate staffing for the number of people that are put into one setting. And so the reason that I mentioned that system and other systems like it is because when we find people crowded together so extremely that they don't even have room, they don't have a bed, for instance, they have to sleep on the floor next to other people who sleep on the floor. That doesn't just promote the spread of communicable disease and the rapid growth of outbreaks. It also promotes the spread of physical and sexual violence and other very adverse health outcomes that are predictable and that really reflect the conditions people have been placed into much more than they reflect the individual characteristics of those people.
Well, you write, quote, "Being incarcerated creates multiple health risks, including infection from communicable diseases, as well as physical and sexual violence," end quote. And you just mentioned that. So why is there such rampant spread of disease and extreme violence in facilities that are supposed to be under strict surveillance and supervision by qualified and trained officials?
Well, I think the second part of your question is important. I think that we have so few staff working in many jails and prisons. You know, there are jails and prisons in this country operating at half or less of the number of correctional or custodial officers that they're supposed to have. So when that occurs, the staff withdraw further away from people. But also, in order to use fewer staff, people, humans who are incarcerated, will be put into more and more crowded situations. But even if that weren't true, the power dynamic and the nature of correctional settings or carceral settings is one that promotes physical and sexual abuse. And so that's always going to be a threat as a health risk for people who go through these places. But certainly in understaffed and overcrowded settings, the proximity of one person to another, the lack of adequate health care, and the lack of basic programs and things to do leads to close contact that can promote both physical and sexual violence, but also spread of disease.
Well, it seems like these are common sense factors. If we know that, putting people in those close proximity facilities with one another, and you're understaffed and you're overpopulated, and you already know that communicable diseases will be spread, that sexual violence will occur, what's the remedy?
Well, these problems often draw us into a pitched battle over not having enough staff or not having enough space. And those are very legitimate and real problems that, you know, correctional officers in some states might get paid about the same as working in a dollar store. That's, or at a, you know, local fast food store. So that's a real problem for that department that wants to recruit people. But if we step back just a little bit, when a hospital, for instance, gets too crowded in their emergency room, what happens is that emergency room goes on diversion, and an alert goes out to EMS dispatch to say, we're too crowded, we can't take people here safely right now. And so then they have to go somewhere else. So that is absolute, and it's absolute because the focus is on the state patient safety. It's on not doing things that are going to cause the death or injury or illness of people who go into that place. We have no such approach to pushing people, more and more people, into jails and prisons. And foundationally, from my standpoint, one of the core reasons is the people who make the decisions about what's safe and good health care and what's adequate in a hospital or a nursing home, those people are mostly, and those institutions are mostly, absent from jails and prisons. So, you know, from CMS to HHS to state departments of health, they're not making decisions about what's okay and not okay in a jail or prison. It's a jailer, it's a sheriff, it's a commissioner of corrections. And I think at the end of the day, that's probably the most fundamental problem we have.
It sounds like we're putting people in charge whose top priority is not the health and well-being of the people that they're in charge of. Tell me about the role of ICE agents in what you call the Farmville Super Spreader event.
Well, my involvement at Farmville was to go investigate the ICE outbreak itself. So to be fair, what I learned about ICE moving people around to get them into Farmville, which is the initiating event for, or the triggering event for the outbreak, I didn't learn that as part of my inspection. I actually learned about it afterwards through reporting at the Washington Post and elsewhere. But what became clear after I'd gone there and investigated this very serious outbreak, including a man's death, was that the facility had actually created some pretty good systems to quarantine newly arrived people if they came from another detention center, kind of off-site so that they could be observed and checked for COVID symptoms before they came into the main facility. That was a sound approach. But then ICE decided to transfer over 70 people from two different facilities, which had never been done before, in mass into the Farmville facility, and without going to this first step of a quarantine, a new admission quarantine that was off-site. And they brushed aside these basic public health measures and caused a very, really an all-encompassing super spreader event. And the reporting I learned after the inspection was that this was done really with no rationale for immigration detention or management of people who were in immigration detention, but that it was an effort to get people, agents, federal agents, to D.C. to put down protests.
My guest is Dr. Homer Venters. He's the author of Outbreak Behind Bars, Spider Bites, Human Rights, and the Unseen Danger to Public Health. When you talk about a super spreader event, what makes a COVID outbreak a super spreader event?
Well, I talk about in the book, there are lots of different ways to define this term, but generally it would be a very small number of cases that then through close contact or rapid transmission create a mushroom number of cases that one would not expect. And so here you had at Farmville, people coming in, 70 people arrived, and some of them had COVID symptoms right away. But then within a couple of days, it was clear that almost everybody in the facility, hundreds and hundreds of people, would become infected. And so it is generally a rate of transmission that exceeds what one would have expected.
In chapter 8, you wrote, quote, COVID-19 ripped through this building, and the women were left largely on their own, caring for each other until some of them became gravely ill, end quote. I got a sense that empathy was in short supply in that facility.
Well, I'll tell you, it was not in short supply among those women. I mean, the stories I heard of women sitting with each other on the floor of the bathroom while one vomited and the other wiped her brow, knowing, you know, the caretakers knowing they were going to get sick. It is an incredible and horrible part of this kind of work, is that you discover that when care is denied by the people who run these facilities or made inaccessible, people care for each other. And it's really incredible. And they can save each other's lives. It's not just, you know, providing comfort. And so the speed with which COVID outbreaks hit and the lack of resources available to actually provide care didn't stop people from caring for each other.
You wrote about the discrepancies between reports you received directly from inmates versus documented information from people in charge. How do you know who to trust inside of jails and prisons?
I think it is almost always the case that the perspective of people who are detained or incarcerated is different than that of administrators, the people who run it. And those administrators will have a different perspective than the health staff or the security staff. And so when conducting a facility inspection, it is important to talk to the bosses, the administrators, but it's also important to have confidential interviews with health staff, security staff, and with detained people. And there are records that can help determine kind of where the truth lies. And so, for instance, if people have been submitting sick call slips that include symptoms of the outbreak, but those sick call slips were never read, or they were even being thrown out, or they just weren't responded to, that gives credence to the idea that people are trying to report symptoms of an outbreak, but the facility simply isn't responding. And that is something that I found over and over.
You wrote, quote, jails, prisons, and immigration detention systems routinely fight to keep independent inspectors out of their facilities, and the COVID-19 pandemic provided a popular rationale for these objections, end quote. Tell me more.
Well, as soon as COVID started, there was use of COVID as a pretext for keeping outsiders from coming into buildings. And so I discuss in the book a case where a colleague who was tasked with doing mental health inspections of a prison system was told she wasn't going to be able to go in because even though she's a doctor and she knows a lot about infection control and would take all sorts of precautions, the prison system said, we don't want to let you in because you might cause a super spreader event. Now that, in my view, was nonsense. The court pushed that aside and she went in and did her inspections. But that tendency to keep people out is always there. And any outbreak, any problem that's health related, you would think means we need to get more eyes in there to understand it, but it can be used quite the opposite as an excuse to keep people out.
You wrote, quote, "This cycle, which plays out in a thousand other ways before and after these outside health staff arrive, is a crucially toxic one because it brings the credibility of the outside health agency to bear in the worst way. When a sheriff or correctional leader touts the great job they've done and cites the endorsement of a health department as evidence, even if the assessment was this type of one-sided affair, the health department or agency has given their seal of approval. But they've also sent a clear message to the people locked up in that facility. We don't believe you and don't need to consider your viewpoint," end quote. What's the point you're addressing?
I think if you're an outsider and you're asked to go investigate an outbreak or anything that relates to public health, you need to confidentially interview people who are experiencing that situation. And you need to choose the people, not let the corrections department choose them for you. And if you haven't done that, then you have really done the pursuit of public health or knowledge about the outbreak a disservice. But you've also really delivered a slap in the face to the people who were there who were actually experiencing this. And I saw this over and over, that health departments would mean well. They would come, and because they're not used to going to a jail or prison, they'd take a guided tour that the administrators gave them. And the end of the day would result in a lot of backslapping and maybe some good ideas or helpful suggestions, but that might happen without even confidentially reviewing people who are experiencing the outbreak themselves.
Well, we've got a minute left, and I just want to ask you this. You write that there are approximately 7,000 facilities in America for incarcerating humans, and thousands die in those facilities every year. Your recommendation is that public health officials can hire formerly incarcerated people who can provide insightful perspectives that can be helpful. Tell me more.
First of all, we have done so much incarcerating in this country that everybody in every position, I think, should and does hire formerly incarcerated people. We have lots of incarcerated people, formerly incarcerated people in our country. But for public health agencies that are tasked with understanding an outbreak, the granular details of where data sits or how data can be hidden or where certain parts of an outbreak might not be apparent to them, that is best known by people who have experienced it themselves. Either they or their families have been through the experience of incarceration. And there's really no better way to understand an outbreak than to work with, as colleagues, people who have seen some of the same systems that are being investigated.
And what did you learn from incarcerated individuals that you hope will serve as a lesson for readers of your book?
Well, I think the first is that basic lesson that you need to confidentially interview people who are incarcerated in the place where you're going. That's number one. Number two is that people who are experiencing the health service, they may have recorded valuable data that isn't apparent to the outsider. So I mentioned sick call slips, for instance, that might not be responded to. There are also other types of data sources, such as grievances. When somebody doesn't get a response to their sick call slip, they might fill out a grievance. Those pieces of paper hold treasure troves of information about when and how an outbreak first started. And it might be completely hidden if you just take the guided tour that the administrators provide.
Well, unfortunately, that's all the time we have. Thank you for writing this very insightful book, Dr. Venters.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
My guest was Dr. Homer Venters. He's the author of Outbreak Behind Bars, Spider Bites, Human Rights, and the Unseen Danger to Public Health. I'm Mike Green. You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio.